You're listening to the Vegans Explore Network, found at vegansexplore.com.
Today we have a special guest. We have Jane Velez Mitchell, and I'm so excited to speak with you on a number of different levels. One being your background in broadcast. That's like a huge passion of mine. So to be able to pick your brain and to learn directly from you and not a Wikipedia page is going to be a true delight. And also to talk to you about all of the work that you've done within the vegan community. And just looking at the shows that are being broadcast on your network and just the passion that you bring to every conversation that you have. I'm excited to have that firsthand. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So we have a tradition here at SoFlo Vegans. The first question is always, what is your vegan origin story? How did it all get started for you? It might have been seeds. It might have been one situation. What's your story?
Well, my mom, who lived to 99 and a half, so I always give her 100, was born in 1916 in the beautiful island of Vieques, which is part of Puerto Rico. It's an island off the coast of Puerto Rico, but it's part of the Puerto Rican Commonwealth. And she had a pet pig. She thought she had a companion animal, a friend, someone she loved. She was very young. She came home from school and the pig had been slaughtered. She fainted. And when she woke up, she was disgusted and shunned meat. So she came to New York by herself on a boat at the age of 12, formed a very successful dance troupe called Anita Velez Dancers. And they toured hotels from the Caribbean, America, United States, and Canada. She met my dad, who was Irish American, who was an advertising executive. He was a big meat eater when he met her, but he converted as well. So we were pescatarians pretty much growing up. We thought of ourselves as kind of vegetarians. I mean, this is in the early 60s. This is not a time when the word vegan was floating around, but my mother was very advanced. She was one of the first hyphenates. She kept her name and added my dad's name. So she was Anita Velez Mitchell. She was doing yoga in the 40s when nobody knew what the heck yoga was. So she was a very avant-garde person who was very into the arts, being a dancer. And then she became a writer, director, really ahead of her time is what I'd have to say. So as I got older, became a journalist, went to New York University. When I graduated, I started working in news. Went around the country, Fort Myers, Florida, Minneapolis, Philadelphia. Then I came back to my hometown, New York. I was raised in Midtown Manhattan, ended up working at WCBS TV. And along that journey, I started seeing the horrors here and there of what we did to animals in the laboratory. Was the first time I saw it when I was in Philly, actually, these horrible head injury experiments on primates that, I mean, it was like a punch to the gut. I didn't know what I could do about it, but I knew there was something morally wrong there, and I had to address it eventually. But I didn't really see a way to do it at that time. And that's why I'm kind of patient with people sometimes when they're saying, well, what can I do? What can I eat? Because it's not really a logical thing. It's really more of a fear of going up against the system. And so when I was back in New York, I spent 8 years at WCBS as a reporter and weekend anchor. And then I got a job as a weekday anchor in LA. And I was working at Paramount Studios. We had a studio on the Paramount lot. And in walks Howard Lyman, the fourth generation cattle rancher who had made a pact with God when he got very ill. And he said, God, if you get me out of this surgery alive, I will reveal the horrors of animal agriculture. And he went on Oprah, and it was a famous, you know, really in the history of television, it's a famous incident where he revealed the horrors. And she said, that just stopped me cold from eating another burger. I think that was the quote. Mm-hmm. Cattleman sued her. She ended up winning that suit. But it turned Howard Lyman, this cattle rancher turned vegan activist, known as the Mad Cowboy, into a bit of a celebrity. And he was doing a tour. And so I interviewed him. And then afterwards, he and his publicist, Mara Nealon, came up to my cubicle where I worked. my desk and they said, "We hear you're a vegetarian." I said, "Yes." And they said, "Do you eat dairy?" And I kind of hung my head because he had just described the horrors of the dairy industry, the boy calves being ripped, put in veal crates, shot, left on dead piles, the mothers grieving, chasing after their babies, just the whole horror of it. And so I kind of hung my head and I said, "Yes." And they pointed their finger right at my nose and they said, "Liquid meat." And that was the moment I went vegan.
Wow.
Now, if they had been oh so very polite and said, "Well, you know, you really should consider giving up dairy because it's really not what you should," I might not have gotten it. I might not have heard their message. They confronted me and they called me out because I was, you know, thinking of myself as an animal lover and blah, blah, blah. But I was contributing mightily to the oppression and suffering of animals by that choice of eating dairy products. And so I thank them every time I run into either one of them. Mar Nealon is a very fierce activist, nobody's fool. I always thank her and I always thank Howard Lyman. So from that point on, I realized I'm a vegan. It took me a month to really change my taste buds. They accidentally put Parmesan cheese in my salad about a month later, and I spat it out. It was tasted awful. Now, I used to love Parmesan cheese. So there's a reason why rehab is at least 28 days. It takes 28 days at least, sometimes a lot more, to change a behavior pattern and change your taste buds and change your habits. So give yourself at least 28 days. You may not love soy milk the first time you taste it or cashew milk. Within 28 days, it'll taste absolutely normal. It takes a while.
And with everything you said, you are going a little bit into the two areas that I really want to focus on in this podcast. One being your professional background and the other being your passion for veganism. So I want to start off with your professional background because there might be a lot of people, especially now when you have, one, you have a captive audience, two, you have time to learn how to put yourself out there in a podcast or a live stream. What was that spark for you? Maybe it was as a child or, you know, coming out of high school that made you wanted to go into broadcast journalism.
Well, as I mentioned, my mother was in the theater and so very theatrical. We had a lot of very fun characters. I don't know if you ever saw the Woody Allen movie, Broadway Danny Rose, but I actually grew up right near the Carnegie Deli. And when I saw that film, I was like, oh, this is like my upbringing because it's a bunch of characters who were from show business, you know, who had various claims to fame. Like one guy was a pool shark whose claim to fame was that he beat Fats Domino once in a, I don't know, they all had their stories, right? And so there were a lot of characters floating around, but it was a showbiz kind of family. And my dad was in advertising, which was print advertising, which was very much about writing ads. And I actually worked for him in the summertime sometimes. So I kind of combined those. When I originally was thinking about journalism, I was thinking about being a syndicated columnist because I thought I would just sit there and write my opinions all day. And how fun is that? And then I actually got interviewed a couple of times. And in the course of being interviewed, I realized I was interviewed on television for a protest that I was holding at one point. And for a couple of other things that were happening, I ended up just being on camera, being interviewed by TV journalists. And I thought to myself, A, I kind of got the bug, but I also thought, like, some of those questions were pretty dumb. I could do a better job than that. So when it came time to signing up, at NYU, I just wrote, I saw that they had a checklist. You could do print journalism or you could do broadcast journalism. And I just checked off broadcast journalism. And here's a funny story. So a friend of mine and I who were both at NYU, I grew up on 57th and 7th, right across from Carnegie Hall. And up the block was the CBS Broadcast Center. Well, my friend said, you know, we could go in. This is in 1973 or 1974 when I graduated high school and was in college. He said, you know, we could go in there. We both wanted to be journalists. He said, we could just go in there and look around. I said, how? He said, just pretend, we'll pretend we're delivering coffee. So we would pick up some coffee from the diner walk in and say coffee delivery and walk right through the gates and spend all day at CBS. And this is the same building where I later ended up working. And this is back in the day where you literally could do that. Now, you know, forget about it. But there was very little security and people were always delivering food. So we just said delivery and we walk right through. I would even go into the studios when they were live on a national broadcast and stand behind the camera and watch the broadcast. And finally, this one guy, this very old crusty guy, goes, "Who are you? Why are you here?" And I said, "Oh, I'm studying to be a journalist." And he said, "Get out while you can."
Oh, wow. So I guess you didn't take his advice.
No, I thought it was all very glamorous and exciting.
So that was so that sounds like that experience. You have that whole that saying, fortune favors the bold. You know, I hear a lot of stories like that where people took chances. I even have a few myself where you're not afraid to put yourself out there to get what you want. So that reinforced you wanting to go into it. And then after you did decide to check that box and, you know, go broadcast journalism for NYU, what was that next event, that next pivotal moment that brought you further and further along in your journey?
Well, I want to say this story, which I don't tell very often because it's kind of weird, but it happens to be the case. Unfortunately, I was stalked for 6 years from like my last year and a half in high school all the way through college. Basically what happened, this is the 70s, you know, it was a crazy time, say no more. I went to a party at Columbia University and there was this guy, I thought he was very cool, hippie. He was much older. And we went out a couple of times, you know, I went to a Yes concert with him. We never did, you know, we never went all the way at all, but, I realized he was kind of crazy pretty quickly. And meanwhile, he knew where I went to school, where I lived, and would follow me around, stalk me for 6 years. I actually took my junior year out of the country at Universidad de las Americas in Puebla, Mexico, to get away. And when I came back, no, he was still there. So the last year, by the way, I'm a recovering alcoholic with 25 years of sobriety. And so that's a really important part of my story. And I was partying. I mean, it was a party time. I guess it always is a party time for teenagers. But, you know, for me, it was a party time. And I had a wild party for my 21st birthday. And then I woke up the next day and I looked in the mirror and I had that moment of clarity, like, oh, my God, you know, you're being stalked, which was very horribly anxiety producing. You are not taking your schoolwork seriously. You just came back from an infamous party school in Mexico. Get it together. You know, he'd actually threatened me several times. And I thought, you know, this is a dangerous situation. My parents didn't really understand, I don't think. And, you know, I literally cleaned up my act and became the most like serious, determined student in my last year. And I did a demo reel, which I memorized the entire script. And I went to the library and I cut out things that I was going to talk about. And I pasted them on a green board behind me. And I got this guy to lend me his camera. And I only had one take. He would only let me do one or two takes. So I had to read the whole thing in one take. And then I did a story. I used to go to this place near NYU, where this older guy who used to work for something, I don't know what, some video thing, he had some kind of, it wasn't a nonprofit, but it was like sort of a, it was a place, an experimental place where people, young people could do videos. And so he helped me with his cameras get my demo reel together. And I remember I said, I need to do a report. And he said, okay. I said, I need a report for my demo reel. And I said, what should I do it on? He goes, I don't care. Go downstairs and do it on the rising price of flowers for all I care. Because there was a flower shop downstairs. So that's exactly what I did. I went downstairs and I said, a rose at any price would smell as sweet. And I did all sorts of quotes from various poems. A rose is a rose is a rose, even though it might cost more, whatever. I did some fun stuff. And That was my report. Literally, I went downstairs to the flower shop and that was the report I used. So then my dad was in advertising, helped me out by placing an ad in Broadcasting Magazine. And I placed an ad and I said, money's no object. I said a couple of things that were very self-flattering and we created an ad. My dad was in advertising, so we made an ad. And so I got a job. I got two job offers. And I took the one in Fort Myers, Florida. And, you know, what I say to kids when I talk to them is, if somebody told you that they'd kill you if you didn't get a job immediately upon graduation, how would you behave differently? Because honestly, the fact that this creep was stalking me motivated me for self-preservation reasons. I knew my parents would never let me leave home without having a job, you know, a career. And I felt like it was a life or death matter. So I did everything it took. I mean, I put together a resume. I placed the ad. I did everything I could possibly think of. And that's what I tell anybody who wants to get anywhere is just do the next indicated thing. Do everything you can possibly do and see what happens. Because usually, even though you may be bashing your head against a wall, you'll break through. And in fact, I think I was the only person in my graduating class to get an on-camera job right upon graduation. And that's not a compliment to me. It's a compliment to what the power of fear will do when you really think that, oh my God, I got to get out of town. There's this nut following me around.
So what was your, so now you're in Fort Myers, Florida. What was your experience coming from New York? Although, you know, there's a joke down here that, you know, probably like 75% New Yorkers in South and Florida. But what was your experience in Fort Myers just as a general location?
I love Fort Myers. In fact, I said, I have to get out of here because it's so much fun that I will never leave if I don't get out of here. So I sold my car to force myself out. But I had an MG Midget. Okay, so when I started my job, first of all, I didn't know how to drive. I was born and raised in Manhattan, and I never drove. I took a driver's test, and I begged the man who's giving me the test, please, with tears in my eyes, my job depends on having a license, please. I couldn't parallel park to save my life. I basically didn't know how to drive. Of course, I go down there being a teenager, basically a glorified teenager. My dad gave me enough money for a down payment. I got an MG Midget, sparkle red, and they literally pushed it off the lot because I had no idea how to drive a stick shift. I proceeded to pretty much destroy that car because I didn't know you needed to put oil. I thought you just needed to put gas. Uh-huh. So I would always, okay, we were all told by the news director to live in the same apartment complex. I'll never forget it. The Richardson Arms. And he happened to be the news director, a very nice person, but a born again Christian, very, very conservative and straight laced. Well, he said, I want you all in the same place near work. So when the big story hits, we can mobilize. Well, the big story never hit little old Fort Myers. But the weekends at the Richardson Arms were pretty, pretty wild. Let's just leave it at that.
Oh, wow.
So having destroyed my car, I would always hitchhike to work or hitch a ride from somebody who lived at the Richardson Arms. So, of course, the woman at the front desk of the TV station thought I was a you-know-what, because one morning I'd be hopping off the back of a motorcycle the next day. But I wasn't. But the appearance was that I was always hitching a ride to work because I couldn't, my car, I didn't know how to drive pretty much. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really, but if you think, but I had a great time at Fort Myers. I did eventually learn to drive and I would take my car to Alligator Alley and shoot over to Fort Lauderdale where there was a very fun scene there. I mean, we're talking 1977, 78. So eventually I said, I got to get out of here. So I sent my tape out to some agent in New York, and she sent it out to somebody, and this guy called me over the phone and offered me a job in Minneapolis. And I had never even uttered or thought the word Minneapolis in my life. It was just like a big giant question mark. And I thought it was a crank phone call. I said, who is this? Cut it out. So he offered me a job, but that at the time it was a much larger market than many. Fort Myers was a very small town at that time. Mm-hmm. By the way, I did the first live video ever, the first live shot. I'll never forget it. From WBBH, the news director came up to me and said, "You know what? You're going to go down to the courthouse and they're going to stick something in your ear and you're going to talk at the same time as the show's on." And I'm like, "What?"
Wow. When was this?
It was about 1977.
Wow. That's cool.
And it was our live debut. And you know what I mean? A remote live.
Yes. Yes.
And so anyway, I got the job in Minneapolis. And I literally was kind of a teenager. I was, you know, at this point, maybe whatever, 24. I wasn't the most mature person. I see some of the kids today who are 19. And I mean, I had my mature aspects, but I was also very, I wanted to have fun. So I packed up all my meager belongings and I got on a plane and I just landed in Minneapolis. To a complete and utter culture shock like I have never experienced before or since. Now, mind you, I did not have any closed-toe shoes. I wore high heel flip-flops. It was the 70s. I had short skirts. I didn't own a coat. It was 45 degrees below zero with the wind chill when I arrived.
Wow. So
it was rough. It was rough.
So how long did that last? How long did you stay in Minneapolis?
2 years.
And that
too long years. The people of Minneapolis are wonderful. They're very nice. It's very cold.
Mm. So then what was I want us to take us into your time working with. So I saw that you worked with Nancy Grace.
Oh, yeah. Well, Flash, I'll just jump forward because you would be like, get me out of this interview. This is going on too long. So I worked in Minneapolis. Then I got a job in Philadelphia. I worked there for a year and a half. Then I got a job in New York, which was my hometown. That was my whole goal, is to get back to New York. So I worked there for 8 years. I was a reporter and weekend anchor. And then I got a chance to go to L.A., where I was a weekday anchor at Paramount Studios with KCAL. And I worked there for 12 years. Then that wrapped. I mean, management changes. I had a great run. 12 years is a long time. And I ended up going a friend of mine who was a reporter and lawyer at another station, Harvey Levin, had just started this show called Celebrity Justice. It's actually the precursor to TMZ. Mm-hmm. And he said, "You want to, you know, I'm looking for reporters." And I was so tired of local news at that point. I was like, yes, let me do it. So I did the show. I ended up covering the Michael Jackson child molestation trial in Santa Maria, California, which was a global coverage. People from around the world, news media from around the world. And I ended up on Larry King Live quite a few times. And then I was a reporter for Nancy Grace nightly from outside the courthouse. And then after that, trial ended with an acquittal on all counts and the show ended pretty much at the same time. And so I was doing fill-in and, Nancy Grace asked me to fill in for her when she went on vacation. And kind of a funny story, I was after the show ended. And at this point, I also came out as gay. That's another little thing I just dropped down. Just a little, let's drop that into the mix. Anyway, I was with my girlfriend at the time in Bora Bora, decided I needed a vacation after that show. And literally, on a catamaran about to leave the shore as this man from the hotel comes running up, handing me a letter. He literally gets his pants wet, handing me this letter. And I was like, what? And I look at the letter and it says, CNN needs to talk to you. And the first thing I thought was, remember, after Michael Jackson was acquitted, he kind of disappeared. And remember, he eventually turned up in Ireland. But people, there was a whole thing of where is he? Where is he? And at one point, Marlon Brando had said to Michael Jackson that he could use his island. I believe it was Tetiaroa, which was right near where we were at. So, of course, the first thing I thought was, oh, no, they want me to go to Tetiaroa. They've heard to check out whether he's there. And I thought, oh my God. But no, they were just calling to find out if I wanted to fill in for Nancy Grace. And I said, absolutely. So after doing that for a while, you know, what happened was Glenn Beck, who had the show prior to Nancy, purportedly, allegedly, what I heard was he stormed off the set one night, which is not what you want to do. And they wanted to replace him immediately. So they called me and I was sitting right here where I live and I was having a cup of coffee and they said, do you want a job? I was like, yes. They said, OK, we can call it Issues with Jane Velez Mitchell. And I said, great, because I've got a lot of issues. And I went to New York. I literally, being an animal activist, the first thing I did was go to the vet and make sure my dogs were certified to fly. Because they said, you're going to go to New York this weekend. And it was Friday. So I literally goes, do the show from L.A. today or today and tomorrow you can go to New York. I literally packed up a few things and my dogs and I flew to New York and I was there for 7 years.
Wow. So now we're going to start bringing your background and broadcast journalism and combine it with your animal activism, your animal rights activism. So at what point did you have the idea to start the Jane Unchained Network?
Well, what happened was when I was at Celebrity Justice, Harvey Levin would have, and it was an ungodly morning hour, like 6:45 a.m. in Glendale, when I live in pretty much Venice, California. You had to have two story ideas. And he would say, where's the celebrity? Where's the justice? And it was kind of a precursor in real life to what he does on the TMZ show now, where he stands. It was exactly like that. And so it was very hard to get celebrities because we were a tabloid show. They didn't want anything to do with us. They'd hang up on us and literally run from us down the street. Mm-hmm. I chased a few of them. And so it occurred to me that I was a burgeoning animal activist at the time and a vegan, that I had gone to PETA galas and things that of that nature, I said, you know, if I asked PETA for some celebrities with their causes, I could have celebrity and the cause is justice. That's exactly what I did. I worked very closely with PETA. We did numerous stories on animal rights at Celebrity Justice. And in fact, we won two Genesis Awards. So from the Humane Society. So that gave me the idea that, yeah, you can use your profession, whatever it is. I don't care if you're a pianist, if you're a plumber, you can use whatever your chosen field is to help animals. So then when I got the job at CNN Headline News, I said, would you mind if I did a little animal segment once a week? And they thought about it and they said, no, sounds fine. Maybe they thought it was going to be pet adoptions. We started with hardcore animal activism. For 6 years, pretty much every Friday, I did like a 4-minute segment on, we were showing pig gestation crates, the horrors of factory farming, laboratory issues. I will always be grateful to CNN for allowing me to do that. They did not stop me. Mm-hmm. And we had all the big leaders in animal activism on, you know, at the time, Nathan Runkel, now Milo Runkel, and many people from all the different groups. And people like Josh Tetrick, who was just starting Just Mayo, was on. And so I realized that, wow, I was getting these people on, you know, who were animal activists. It was a blessing. I will always be grateful for having had that opportunity. So when the show wrapped in late 2014, I left on very good terms. I said I had a good run, you know, on to the next thing. And I said, do you mind if I take my social media, which is Facebook? They had built up a whole Facebook for me, Instagram, et cetera. Was it Instagram or just Twitter? I can't remember exactly which ones, but yeah, definitely Facebook and Twitter. So they said, sure. So I realized with my girlfriend at the time, who's still a good friend, Donna, I said, Donna, now we can go to animal rights protests. Because when you're a reporter, you can't go to animal rights protests unless you're covering them, which mainstream media pretty much never does, hardly ever. So she said, yeah, Jane, you're Unchained. So I said, oh yeah, Jane Unchained. I said, that has a fun ring. So when I started covering the protests, I noticed immediately there was a missing component. There were people going to tremendous lengths to protest, sometimes barely wearing any clothes in very cold weather. People are trying to get indoors. It was cold in New York City. And nobody's documenting it. And I said, oh, bingo, this is what I can do. And somebody at CNN, a top executive, before I left, I asked to meet with her. She's one of the top people. And she said, your passion is clearly animals. Why don't you do that exclusively? That's your niche. That's almost a direct quote. So I felt like that inspired me also, like, okay, let me just do this full time. And I'll never forget, one of the first protests we covered was in Brooklyn outside the Staples Center, where my good friend Cynthia King had brought something like 200 of her dance students who were budding activists as well. There were a large contingent of people protesting against Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. And I'll never forget, it was 9 degrees. You may have noticed I don't like cold weather. It was 9 degrees. My GoPro camera was shaking. And I was like, is this really worth it? And I thought, yes, these animals are suffering. It's worth it. So I documented that news report. And, you know, not because of me, because of PETA, because of the work of primarily PETA, but a lot of different organizations. Look, it wasn't a wasted cause. Look, Ringling Brothers does not exist anymore. So for those activists who feel sometimes that, am I making a difference? Is it worth it? I'm so exhausted. I'm burnt out. Yes, it does. Every single vegan, please become an activist. Please use the best tool you have, which is your phone. Your phone has cameras now that are equivalent to movie cameras a decade ago. You can do anything with your phone and put it on social media. That's how we're changing the world. You mentioned Tabitha Brown. Tabitha with her coconut carrot bacon video, 12 million views now. She's got a show with Ellen. I mean, there's a perfect example of one person doing one video about one dish having a huge impact.
Now, when you say become an activist and use your phone, and you brought up Tabitha Brown, it's when I think of being an activist, initially when I became vegan, it was going to protest. It's a lot of the things that PETA has done over the years. Are you saying that there are different ways of being an activist? What are some of the distinctions?
Well, yeah, I think the sky's the limit. I think you find out what you're good at. So I've been in media my whole life. So I'm using social media to do journalism. And now in COVID, we have anchors. Well, just to get to the end of that story, flash forward, Facebook Live came around. And by that time, I had moved to LA and I realized, wow, because I was always a live reporter pretty much on my whole career. I was always alive. And I thought, wow, this is great. I don't have to edit all these, spend all these hours editing. I could just go live. And then I immediately, very soon realized, you know, there's so much happening. It's such a global movement. It's exploding. The animal rights movement was exploding starting around the time that I started Jane Unchained, 2015. And I said, we need everybody doing this. So now we have 70 volunteer contributors around the world going live. And we have like more than a dozen anchors who do their shows. They're a weekly show. And so it's a team effort. It's not me alone. We have an incredible team of volunteers and we have a great, very tiny group of people who are actual, you know, they work on it. But mostly it's a volunteer effort. And so like that. And we try to encourage everybody, you know, yeah, I'd like Jane Unchained to grow. But more than that, I'd like to get the world plant-based. I mean, frankly, after 38 years of working fiendishly in broadcast television where you don't even go out to lunch, I'd like to be sitting on the beach reading a trashy novel and eating some vegan bonbons. But this needs to be done. So every day I wake up and, you know, 12 hours a day just working on this. And we're a nonprofit. We're a 501c3. So there's a lot of paperwork involved too, which I do. You know, we're using the power of social media. If you're a singer, write a song. If you're a lawyer, join a group like Animal Legal Defense Fund or one of these other organizations, Non-Human Rights Project. Lend your expertise to these organizations that are fighting in court for animal rights. If you're, you name it, I don't care what your profession is. And here's another thing we're doing. Is we are really trying to create a veganomy and unite all vegans So we just started something called plantbasedneighbor.com, which is in beta testing, but it will very soon be an app. But we want to work out all the kinks before we make it an official app. So I'm urging every vegan to sign up to Plant-Based Neighbor. You can find other vegans who live in your neighborhood, and you can also put your profession up so that if you're, let's say, just for example, a massage therapist and you're vegan, frankly, if I'm going to get massage, I want to be massaged by a vegan. I don't want to have some meat eater breathing down my neck. Okay. So ditto for a hairdresser, for a plumber, I would rather give my money to a vegan. So since a lot of that is geographically determined, you are not going to pick a hairdresser who's 100 miles away. Having these people in your neighborhood is really important, and it builds a sense of community. And also during this time of COVID, you won't feel so alone. So one of our guys, Kenziah Rubens, who lives in downtown LA, is our Instagram editor. I said, Kenziah, sign up for Plant-Based Neighbor. He said, I don't think so, Jane. I live in downtown LA. There won't be anybody. I said, just do it. Guess what? 162 people in his zip code.
Whoa.
He found 162. He called me up. He goes, oh my God, Jane, I can't believe this. There's 162 people in my zip code. I said, yeah, there is. Yeah, there is.
Wow. So, and that's in beta. That's amazing.
Yeah. So please sign up for Plant-Based Neighbor. And it's, you know, some people have called me back. Well, it should do this. It should do that. First, we're getting the technology down, and then we're going to be able to add on all these layers. Like, for example, whenever COVID is, you know, a part of our past, and it could be a long time, but whenever it is, wouldn't we like to organize vegan block parties? Wouldn't we like to organize vegan ride shares to VegFest? There are so many things we can do once we have this infrastructure in place and to create the veganomy. And we're going to also have giveaways for those who've signed up as we go along. There's going to be some exciting giveaways. So it's just a fun way to connect with the people in your neighborhood. And you really feel like, I'm sure you have this experience of a vegan family. It really expands that notion that we're not alone. Even if the people around us are grilling dead flesh, we've got our compadres, you know, around.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I love so much about the vegan community is that it's not just one particular type of person. It's so diverse in the people that you meet. You just share this common, you just have that one thing in common of you're not doing harm to animals. And that spreads the compassion in a lot of different areas. So what I want to ask you now is, you've been covering the vegan community for a while now. What have you noticed? Like, what are some of the trends that you're noticing that have been developing, let's say, over the last 3 years?
Well, I think the Beyond Meat initial public offering, which was the most successful IPO since the 2008 financial crisis, was a major breakthrough for our movement. I noticed it just with our neighbors. My neighbors around here, just like many of us, we got the eye rolls and the it's a choice and all of that. But then once money entered the equation, because our society values money almost above all else, which is the big problem. But once it started making money, I noticed that there was a new respect. And people would come up to me, that Beyond Meat, huh? Wow. Wow. Hmm. And so then they started trying it. Isn't that interesting? Is that when it started to make money, people started trying it. And because Beyond Meat existed prior to the IPO. I mean, it's based here in El Segundo. And actually, Jane Unchained did a great tour with Ethan Brown, the founder of the facility. And so it's always been it's been out there for quite a few years. But when it went public, wow, I felt a new respect, a new legitimacy. And so I think that was a big, big turning point. And I also think this COVID crisis is a huge turning point for our movement. You know, advertiser-based media generally does not want to talk about the horrors of animal agriculture. And they pretty much pretend it doesn't exist. Even now, well, they've been forced to talk about what they call meat packing plants, which sounds like somebody putting a few steaks in a suitcase to go on vacation. They don't say the word slaughterhouse, but they've been forced to talk about it because slaughterhouses, along with nursing homes and prisons, are some of the hotspots, the main hotspots of COVID-19, and slaughterhouse workers are getting sick and they are dying. So they're covering it from a workers' rights perspective. And also because the Trump administration declared slaughterhouses critical infrastructure under the Defense Protection Act, thereby robbing a lot of these workers who are amongst the poorest and the lowest socioeconomic group of any right, the rights to sue that they might otherwise have, by declaring them essential workers. Basically, it's in a large sense a death march to go into these slaughterhouses. Something like 26,000 slaughterhouse workers or those connected to slaughterhouses have gotten sick, and 95 at least people tied to slaughterhouses have died. And so, you know, it's now for the liberal media something they're looking at from a workers' rights perspective, but mostly to call out the Trump administration. However, they are not looking at it from a perspective of the environmental wreckage that animal agriculture causes, and obviously the horrific suffering to animals, and also the psychological, emotional, and spiritual devastation of these poor people who are forced to go in there and kill every day, day after day. They get alcoholism, drug addiction, depression, suicide. I mean, it is the job nobody wants. So anybody now who is eating a chicken wing or a slice of bacon or a meat burger, guess what? You're co-signing the possible death of a human being, too. Slaughterhouses are also slaughterhouses for people.
Mm. Wow. So I know at the beginning of this year, you touched a little bit about it in terms of the environmental impact of the meat industry or the animal agriculture. Have you noticed that more outlets or more organizations are pointing out that link between animal agriculture and the environment, or do you still feel like there's this haze of ignoring the elephant in the room?
Oh yeah, that's a great question. By the way, we're involved with the Boycott Meat Coalition, and every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on Jane Unchained's Facebook, we do a Boycott Meat Roundtable with workers' rights advocates in Iowa who are speaking up for these workers who are being hospitalized and dying. So I think that very much flies in the face of what some people want to believe, a lie that they tell themselves, that, oh, animal rights activists only care about animals. No, we care about people too. We want to eliminate human world hunger, which only exists because of animal agriculture. We could live in a world of natural abundance where everybody has all the food they want. We are focusing on the least efficient food source, animals, who obviously eat so much more than they produce as food. 70% or more of all soy is fed to farm animals. A huge percentage of the corn and other staples are fed to animals who then don't produce that much food. So if we just fed that food directly to humans, we could end world hunger, and we could also lower the price of food because scarcity creates increases in price. Anybody who thinks about it for more than 5 seconds would know this, but denial is a very powerful thing. As for the environmental movement, I want to give a shout out to Joaquin Phoenix for calling them out in a very strategic way during the awards ceremony this past year, the SAG Awards, the Golden Globes, and even the Oscars, and basically saying to the Golden Globes and the SAG Awards, thank you for being plant-based, because this acknowledges the devastating impact that animal agriculture has on our environment. I think that now there's no excuse for any environmental or conservation group to ever serve meat. I urge everyone, and the first thing I ask if I'm invited to one of these environmental or conservation events is, are you serving dead animals or dairy, or is this plant-based? We have to put pressure on these groups to walk the walk. It's absurd. conservation, I mean, habitat destruction for cattle grazing land is the primary reason why we're experiencing habitat and wildlife that animals are being driven to extinction because they don't have anywhere to live because we've destroyed it. Since the start of the year, we've destroyed a part of the Amazon that's equivalent to more than 20 Manhattans for cattle grazing, So these hypocrites who say they're environmentalists, but they're eating animals, you are the problem. And, you know, it reminds me of addiction because in 12-step, there's a saying, we thought it was the solution, but it was the problem. We thought alcohol was our solution after a bad day of work or after a good day at work, after any day at work. We thought it was the solution, but it was actually the problem. And it's the same thing with meat and dairy. We think it's the solution. So these people who want to end world hunger and feed the hungry, they're going to go and feed meat to people who are hungry right now. That's why I'm so thrilled to be working with Maggie Baird. You know, our show, New Day, New Chef on Amazon Prime. We have the first season, which is fantastic, top vegan chefs cooking. Now we have a special edition, Support and Feed. So you can put in New Day, New Chef, because it's a new day. You can be a new chef, or you can put Support and Feed to Support and Feed. Maggie Baird, who happens to be Billie Eilish's and Finneas's mom, is a committed vegan, as is Billie Eilish and Finneas. And she's created this system where you donate to Support and Feed. Support and Feed gives it to the vegan restaurants. The vegan restaurants make this incredible food, and then Support and Feed delivers it to children's charities, to senior centers, and all sorts of people who are really struggling right now. But the frustration that these so-called, you know, hunger groups are feeding meat to people who are hungry, I personally know this is happening because I have a friend who actually was my rollerblading teacher 28 years ago, who helped me get sober because I'd always show up hungover for my rollerblading classes. And I'd say, I need a cup of coffee before we do this. Anyway, she helped me get sober. Well, now she's an elderly person and she is a vegan and she cannot get any group to feed her vegan food. And she calls me and says, Jane, they're bringing me pastrami sandwiches and I can't eat it. I said, well, I work with one of our contributors, Kim Delgado, who found some vegan food and regularly delivers it to her. But it's frustrating because feeding cancer-causing food, processed meat is cancer-causing officially from the World Health Organization. Food that's going to increase your chance of getting diabetes or worsen your heart disease. Those are the underlying health conditions that make you more likely to get very ill and die from COVID-19. It's crazy to be feeding meat and dairy to people who are struggling during COVID-19. It's just going to make them sicker and more likely to succumb. So in any case, I don't even remember what, don't get me started. Oh yeah. You asked about the environmental groups. Okay. So let me say this. I've butted heads with a few environmental groups. I can tell you that, yes, I did lose my temper on a couple of occasions. Jane Fonda told me to, she said, you be quiet. That's a direct quote. And it even got written up, you know, Jane Fonda shouts down vegan activists at one of these climate events because they were not talking about animal agriculture's impact on climate change. They were talking about the amorphous idea of fossil fuels. Now, there's a lot of young kids there. I bet you if you ask them to really define fossil fuels, they'd be hard-pressed to do it a lot. So what the industry doesn't mind you doing is railing against fossil fuels because they realize that point A to B is very amorphous. What are you going to do to stop fossil fuels, right? Okay. Fly less, but there's something very concrete you can do when you want to stop animal agriculture's role in climate change. You can stop eating animals and their byproducts. They're terrified of that. So they actually encourage the protests against fossil fuels, they being the big industries that have underwritten some of these events. So the truth is that's why what Joaquin Phoenix did was so powerful, because he spoke that same exact message standing right next to Jane Fonda, and she didn't tell him to be quiet. She sat there in the same red, or stood there in the same red coat and red hat, and listened. And, you know, we're all a work in progress, myself included. I've got plenty of hypocrisies that I need to deal with, just like every other human being. So I'm inviting environmentalists to get it. If you care about people, don't co-sign the death of a slaughterhouse worker. If you care about human world hunger, don't eat animals. If you care about climate change, transition to plant-based, reduce the meat and the dairy, and we'll all be a lot better off for it. So I don't know that scolding is the answer. I don't really have the answer for the climate issue. I do feel that the truth is breaking through. And I think that you've got intellectuals like Ezra Klein writing a very, very powerful article in Vox recently. You had Jonathan Safran Foer writing an opinion piece in the New York Times recently. So I think they're starting to get that it's kind of like cigarettes. It's icky. And it's not something that anybody who's high-minded wants to have anything to do with.
And I, as we wrap up the podcast, I want to focus the last part of our conversation on a topic that has come up recently. It's been around for a while, but it's talking about social justice. And there's been a lot of conversations about the vegan community not being as inclusive are as diverse as some would like it to be. Now, I've noticed some things with the Jane Unchained Network, some you've answering that with some of the programming that you have, some of the conversation. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk to our audience about, you know, where your thoughts are on that conversation.
Well, it's a very good point. Room for improvement. Like, until it was pointed out, I may not have been as sensitive to that. Although I consider myself a person of color. I'm Puerto Rican, along with being Irish, and I've got German and Spanish. But I consider myself, I'm very proud to be an earthling. Let's put it that way. I mean, I think that, unfortunately, our administration has encouraged division. And listening to the Mary Trump book, wow, it spells it all out, man. The dysfunctional childhood. It's a must listen because then you get it. It's all about low self-esteem. And that's my personal opinion. When I see anybody, I've been discriminated against. I've been talked down to because of my heritage. People have assumed that maybe I grew up in poverty because of my heritage, which is not the case. But I always look at it from the same way I look at people who wear fur. Contrarian indicator, low self-esteem. If you need to put somebody down here to feel up here, it means you've got a self-esteem problem. And I noticed that those who, when I was growing up, I had a very interesting background. I told you about the showbiz aspect. And my dad had a whole other set of friends who were very highfalutin. My mother would roll her eyes. But, you know, there were some what you'd call society types. And what I noticed were the pretenders were often very standoffish and snobby. But the people who were really secure at being at the top of the ladder were often very nice because they didn't have anything to prove. They weren't socially insecure. So when I see somebody wearing a Rolex or a fur or being a bigot, I think low self-esteem doesn't feel good about themselves. And this is totally confirmed with the Mary Trump book. And that's really a commentary on them. I'm not going to let that impact my feelings of how I feel. You know, that's a sick person. That's a sick person. And I don't necessarily have to cure them, but they don't have to wash their dirty water on me. So that's my personal philosophy. But that being said, social change is super important. We had the Me Too movement where women rose up and we started seeing how women are objectified and treated like commodities, especially in Hollywood. I mean, started with, you know, Hollywood to a large degree and media. It's all I've never personally, I'm happy to say, maybe it's because I'm so loud and obnoxious, I've never personally experienced, aside from being stalked as a young woman, but I've never had a Me Too moment. But then you have the Black Lives Matter movement. Again, rising up, causing social change. It's super powerful and fantastic. And I see those as coming together as rising up against the patriarchy. The patriarchy isn't working anymore. It's making 0.1% of the world have all the wealth of billions of people. It's a dysfunctional system. So I think that the movement reflects this intolerance, obviously, discrimination, police violence, et cetera, you know, that specific. But I think on a bigger scale, there's an uprising from everyone who feels disenfranchised to overthrow the patriarchy, however they define that in their minds. And, you know, a very amazing activist, Carol Raphael Davis, said to me, if you think about the French Revolution, you probably think of thousands and thousands and thousands of people, mobs. No, it was a very small number of people who, I believe, stormed the Bastille to overthrow the monarchy. So what we're seeing is, and COVID-19 fits right into this, I think we're seeing a huge shift. That's why, as irritating as it can be sometimes, I'm letting nature, I look at, and I didn't get this, this is from Dr. Silas Rao. Again, I'm a groupie, he's a genius. When COVID happened, and I was doing a live interview with him, he said, Jane, isn't it interesting how nature waited till we had all these techniques so we could communicate remotely before shutting us down? This is an intervention from nature saying, go to your rooms, humans. You've been terrible. Think about how you've behaved and either come out more evolved or you're finished. Whoa. As soon as I heard that, I was like, wow, he's right. This is an intervention from nature. There's a lot of ways we as a species have been very cruel. And we need to clean up our act as a species. And across the board, we've been bad. We're destroying our planet. We're being mean to each other. We're being horrifically, sociopathically, sadistically cruel to animals. All of that has to change. Now, I want to say one other thing. I know we're probably out of time, but I'm watching this show on Amazon. And yes, of course, I'm watching New Day, New Chef on Amazon Prime and Support and Feed on Amazon Prime. But I'm also watching a show about the plague, which wiped out half of Europe in the 14th century. And what the professor says, it's brilliant. It changed the entire society. It was a feudalistic society until the plague hit. But what happened was you were either a peasant, a clergy, or a nobility. And that was a system. And when the plague hit and wiped out half of Europe, then the survivors were like, wait, I don't have to work on this land and work for that person. I could take my skills and go next door where this guy is absolutely desperate for workers, and I'm going to charge him. It created the modern, it ushered in the modern era. And watching this, I think we are also going to be ushering in a totally new era in human history. And if we don't get it this time, the next pandemic, which is, of course, all brought on by our abuse of animals, will be even deadlier likely. So that's what I see. And I see that part of that future has to be transitioning to a plant-based world, because once we stop oppressing the absolutely most voiceless and powerless amongst us, we will have a different attitude toward each and every one of us. Mm-hmm.
So as we powerful words, and I'm glad that you brought up Dr. Silas Rao. I did a podcast with him, and I took a piece away similar that like you, as far as like the acronym of HEAL, you know, health, environment, animals, and love. And that changed my life. Because for the longest, I was just looking at the health aspects, the environmental and the animal. But for me, I'm one of the main reasons I'm vegan is for the compassion aspect. Because just like you said, if you can have compassion for animals and not do harm to animals, you know, that then creates that building block for how you treat other people in your life. And not just how you treat other people, but how you treat yourself. So I just wanted to echo that, because That was a powerful moment for me.
And I just wanted to say, getting back to your original question, yes, when we looked at our programming, we said we could be more diverse and we made changes. And I'm very happy to say that a lot of those changes were in effect before, were in place before the Black Lives Matter movement sprung up. But we accelerated it and made sure that it's a part of our programming. And it's absolutely important because some of the greatest leaders in our movement are happen to be African-American, and because African-Americans are the fastest growing demographic in vegan in the United States. So I think that the last thing I'd like to say about that is we need to take the power back. If you look at where the money that goes into fast food, which is the basically the building block, the glue of the meat and dairy industry, without fast food, it would collapse. Just like without schools, the dairy industry is collapsing. But if you look at the core of meat and dairy, it is fast food. And if you look at what the fast food companies believe and where they send their money, they are funding the oppressors. The majority of these fast food companies send money to the MAGAs, the Trumps. This is documented. Dr. Milton Mills is the one who has really made a point of this and said, stop funding the people. Don't go to a protest and then go to a fast food restaurant and eat because you're funding the opposition. And in a society where money talks, to take back that power, imagine if every person of color in the United States boycotted meat and particularly boycotted fast food. Imagine the leverage. Imagine the power.
And we've seen that in history on what that sort of people coming together can do to shift the way, you know, the economy works or the way that injustices are presented upon the people. I'm talking about the boycotts on the bus boycotts. So let's wrap up our conversation with some valuable resources, our individuals, because I know you've spoken to a lot of people throughout the course of the over the years. What are some resources you would point people to, including your website, if they want to get more involved, become an activist, or just learn more about the vegan lifestyle?
Yes. Well, you can go to janeunchained.com. And by the way, if you want to be a contributor, you can be a contributor. There's a join the team little tab and just sign up. And we'd love to have you, assuming you're vegan. And of course, go to Amazon Prime and watch our, we have Countdown to Year Zero, the documentary. We also have New Day, New Chef and New Day, New Chef Support and Feed. And those are vegan programs. The more people watch, the higher they go on the algorithms and therefore exposed to more pre-vegans. I don't call people non-vegans. I say they're pre-vegans. And it's also on public television stations around the country. And, you know, I'm a big supporter of PETA and of Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and of Mercy for Animals and of all In Defense of Animals. All these groups are doing incredible work. I would support them. You know, sometimes somebody said to me, by the way, and I obviously don't drink, I'm 25 years sober. If every person in the animal rights movement just gave up alcohol and took the money they spent on alcohol and gave it to an animal rights group, we could literally hit the tipping point within months. And so that discretionary income that you might not be spending now, because you're not out and about as much, hopefully you're staying safe. You know, make a donation, go to Support and Feed and so keep your vegan restaurants open. It's super important that we keep our vegan restaurants open. We don't want to wake up to a world where there's only fast food companies left after this debacle. So I make it a point to order from vegan restaurants, even if I don't exactly need it. Like as Angela Mean said, who's shown on our Support and Feed show, she runs Jack Food Cafe. She said, vegan restaurants have been hit particularly hard because vegans can just get a bag of brown rice and a bag of black beans and survive fine for months. And so we have to realize that it's really incumbent upon us to support those vegan restaurants. Make it a point if you can. I mean, obviously, people are struggling right now, But if there's discretionary income you're going to use it to keep these vegan restaurants open, because we have to help them survive this crisis.
Mm. And are there any closing remarks that you, maybe something we didn't touch on or something you wanted to reiterate for our audience?
Well, I'll just say, as Charles Dickens said, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. Sometimes things look very bleak. Every day I get dozens of emails with terrible stories about animal torture and what they're doing, whether it's factory farming or the labs or the dog meat trade. But then we're seeing the world change in real time. As, for example, COVID-19, a lot of people are afraid to eat meat because, if you think about it, okay, COVID-19 swept through the slaughterhouses. There they are, sweating us, sweating right onto the meat. Do you want to touch that? So people are exploring Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods, for example. Those products are made without any human hands ever touching them. They are clean products. So I would say just have faith. I mean, I have faith that, as they say, as Martin Luther King said, the arc of justice is long, but it bends toward history. If we all keep just powering forward and doing the next indicated thing, and every food piece, every dish we make, take a picture of it, put it on Instagram, share out the videos, share this video out, work it however you can work it. I do believe that we are on the cusp of hitting the tipping point. The young people are leading the way because they're not as brainwashed. They don't watch the boob tube. They're on social media where you can't be brainwashed as easily. And I think that we are going to achieve what Dr. Rao wants to achieve, which is a vegan world by 2026. Let's do it.
Yes, yes. And I want to thank you so much for taking this time. I know you're running a network. There's a lot going on, but I appreciate you speaking with our audience here at SoFloVegans.com. And if you're listening to this right now, go to SoFloVegans.com/podcast, where you will find the show notes for this episode, links to what a lot of what was discussed. And thank you so much. Thank you so much, Jane Velez Mitchell.
Well, Sean, it was a delight. You asked some great questions, and it's really been fun hanging out with you.